Hi, Con.
How you doing, Connor?
I'm doing well. A little bit sick, so I may not be as sharp today, but maybe I will actually perform better, like Michael Jordan did when he had the flu.
Ah, I had a little head cold last week at this time. Not fun.
No.
But you're still out in Southern California, right?
Yes, I am. So hopefully the healing sunshine will take its effect.
Life is tough. So I thought we'd start off with a little personal news. You, of course, as part of Team Sullivan, are moving over to the Daily Beast, right?
Yes, the Daily Dish goes to the Daily Beast on April 5th, I believe.
A Tuesday.
Yeah, I think that's right. I could be wrong. So somewhere right around then.
It could be the 4th. It could be Monday.
Wherever it is, you'll just go to andrewsullivan.com, and it'll take you there wherever it is. So that's kind of emblematic of, you know, won't make a big difference in my life since I'm working remotely out from California. I think Patrick Appel, I think he goes into the Atlantic office now and then, and of course he won't do that anymore. And so it'll definitely make a difference for him. And, of course, it'll be sad to see the Dish leave the Atlantic, even as it's exciting to see it at the Daily Beast. They're both places I like. I intend to keep writing for the Atlantic in a freelance capacity. And I've written for a long time as a columnist at the Daily Beast, so I definitely feel very much at home with the people that run both places.
So is that the size of Team Sullivan? Is it those three?
It's Patrick Appel, it's Chris Bodiner, Zoe, I'm blanking on Zoe's last name, I don't know why, and Andrew. So it's five of us all together.
Gotcha. And so are you guys like a package deal?
Well, I don't know if we're a package deal. I am not privy to how Andrew did all of his negotiations or even how his contract worked at the Atlantic. So I have no idea, actually.
So then Who do you get your paycheck from, Andrew or whatever Andrew's ultimate employer is?
Andrew's ultimate employer.
Okay, gotcha. So you're going to have to go through whatever new HR the Daily Beast has. And when I was at the Atlantic, I went through all their HR. So you go through all that stuff with the ultimate employer, not Andrew.
Right, yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah, luckily the HR people at the Atlantic make everything very easy, which is good for me because I'm very disorganized with that kind of stuff. So
they do. I will second that. They're a professional first-rate operation.
Indeed they are. And you're making a big move, too. You're going to the Washington Examiner?
Yeah, I don't know how big it is. It's, you know, a couple metro stops.
Right.
But, yeah, I will be ceasing my role here at the Heritage Foundation as the official blogger. And I'm never big on titles, so I don't know what my title will be at the Examiner. But I will be doing some 2012 kind of coverage and aggregating an analysis for them and a column on Mondays in the print edition. And contributing to the Beltway Confidential blog with Ferdoso and Carney and all those guys.
Okay. And what kind of stuff is your column going to be about? Also political election 2012 kind of stuff?
Well, in my understanding, it can be, you know, kind of whatever I want. It can be, you know, very policy focused, like most of the stuff I do at Heritage is. Mm-hmm. With the landing pages and the 2012 stuff, you know, I might just be tired of politics and the 2012 race once I'm done with that for the week. So you know, I might want to do something on the minimum wage or gas prices or something like that.
Right. I would be tempted if I had a column that was truly wide open to just name myself the Lakers beat writer for a publication that would never have one otherwise and just go to all the games and write that up, but it probably wouldn't work.
I had no idea you were an NBA fan. Is that your first passion?
I would say the Lakers are the team that I grew up with and the biggest team that I still follow. I mean, I like college basketball. I usually watch March Madness every year, although I haven't been paying attention to it this year yet, but the NBA is definitely my favorite among football, baseball, basketball. I played tennis, too, growing up, so I watched tennis.
Fair enough. I think we had very different sports appetites. I never followed the NBA, and I definitely did not play tennis. But
yes,
takes different strokes.
Indeed. Well, so you're going to be covering election 2012, so let's talk about that. What are your thoughts looking at the GOP field?
Well, you know, there's been lots of talk recently. You know, George Will has a number of pieces, and, you know, if you watch Lawrence O'Donnell any night, you know, he already says it's plenty or nobody. You know, Will, of course, has narrowed it down to five. And I wish I could be contrarian and say they're wrong, but I don't. I really do think it's a small field. I don't take any of the I call them the infotainment candidates, you know, all that seriously. You know, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, Palin, Huckabee. You know, I think they're all in the same boat. Well, they're not even all in the same boat, of course, because you know Fox canceled the contracts of Gingrich and Santorum and Pat Dawn, right. Halen and Huckabee. So they're not all the same boat, but they were. Well, and you can even throw John Bolton in there too. Fox kept his contract too. But I actually think it was kind of a telling move by Fox, and I think it was actually if I was going to do an analysis and say these are the top five of those group, rank them in order of who was really going to run and who wasn't. You know, I would have put mm-hmm. Gingrich and Santorum at the top of the list. So I think they actually nailed that one.
So you refer to them as the infotainment candidates just because they all play sort of pundit roles on TV?
Yeah. You know, their existence depends on them having a political public persona that, you know, for Gingrich, it's a much larger empire. Palin also has other, you know, streams of money coming in from speaking engagements and the rest of it. So does Huckabee. But, yeah, you know, flirting with the idea of running for president is part of their job, basically.
Right,
and
yeah.
So,
yeah, it's been a fascinating thing to watch the sort of overlap between Fox and politics and the interesting position they find themselves in. I saw a piece last night about how Sarah Palin consulted consulted Roger Ailes,
right,
when she was deciding whether or not to fire back during the whole Tucson shooting, and she felt like she was being blamed and put out the whole blood libel statement, and I guess Roger Ailes advised her against it, and according to this story, was miffed that she did put out the statement, and so he was acting almost as both political advisor and boss at the same time, and just a lot of sort of weird lines and boundaries falling, and pretty complicated thing to navigate.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, she came to him for advice and she didn't follow it. So, you know, I think a lot of people would look at that as kind of a slap in the face. But besides the fact, I mean, if you're Roger Ailes and you're making these kinds of decisions as to which of these commenters are for real and you need to keep them on and which of them aren't, you know, you can look at that and that say, you know, that wasn't too smart of a move. You know, that signals to me that she's not serious. So, you know, we'll go ahead and keep her on.
Right. Well, and it seems to me that there's all kinds of thorny questions here, right? Like, Roger Ailes has a huge financial stake in Sarah Palin. Is it big enough that he would kind of think about, maybe I don't want her running for president and leaving. Maybe I want her on the air. Or maybe I do want her running for president. But it seems like the kind of thing that, you know, if someone were running Fox News and wanted to sort of skew the news in various ways to make their desired outcome come out as far as the personnel that they have, they could certainly do that. They would have a huge financial incentive to do that. I'm not alleging that that's happening now. I certainly haven't observed it watching Fox News and thinking, oh, they're doing this for this reason. But it seems like something that I can't think of another news organization who has faced it in quite the same way before.
Oh, no, I can't think of one off the top of my head either. I mean, you know, I guess Chris Matthews was flirting with for a while and running for Pennsylvania Senate. Pat's too old to run anymore. But you're right, I can't think of any off the top of my head. But, you know, I don't know if Roger Ailes has that big an investment in Palin. I mean, they, you know, they do have overlapping financial interests. But, you know,
he pays her $1 million a year, right?
No, I understand. But, you know, if she stops showing up tomorrow, those checks stop coming in. It's not like he you know, built her up from a no talent anywhere and you know has a lot invested in her, and then all you know it's not like she's like some prized NBA rookie that if she walks off and takes a free agency the next day he's out a bunch of stuff.
Right, she's like the guy with the veteran exception,
right,
the million-dollar
right.
veteran exception.
So, you know, they definitely have overlapping, you know, financial interests, but, you know, I think it'd be inaccurate to say that he has a lot invested in her.
Right. Well, what I have been, what I've been disappointed in watching the 2012 GOP side of things is the sort of growing attacks on Mitch Daniels, who is the candidate that, or at least one of the couple candidates that I would most like to see get through. You know, if the election were tomorrow, I would certainly vote for Daniels over Obama. That's not to say that I won't watch the campaign and learn more about everyone as it goes, but it seems to me that he's a really successful governor and that he is one of the most serious voices of fiscal conservatism in the country, and that he has credibility on that issue. I agree with him that it is the most important issue facing us right now, and it seems like a lot of the grassroots Republicans agree with this too. That was a big part of the Tea Party, that we sort of have this unsustainable fiscal situation that we need to rectify, and that it's an issue of both prudence and freedom. And so I sort of I agree with all that, and I've been surprised actually to see some of the attacks on Daniels, to me, for reasons that seem kind of more talk than walk, more rhetoric than the substance of what he does. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, you have to be a bit more specific. He's been coming under fire on a couple wings. I mean, I would say that I agree with you. He's definitely one of the stronger candidates. I would definitely have him in my top two. I'd say it'd be Palenti or Daniels if I had to bet today.
Right.
But
I guess
name the attacks and I'll tell you what I think about them.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there have been sort of two lines of attacks. One, people have been upset about him saying that there should be a social truce, and he's responded to this a couple times in the media and basically said, I'm sorry if I offended anyone by this. I just think that the fiscal issues are the biggest and that you're going to have a big tent if you want to solve those things. And my detractors underestimate how hard it's going to be to pass serious fiscal reforms, the kind that you need to get the country back on the right track. The other line has concerned, like Jennifer Rubin has been kind of attacking him at her blog on the Washington Post.
Yes, she has. Jennifer Rubin is definitely not a fan of Mitch Daniels.
And I kind of don't understand it. You know, she wrote this post about Chris Christie. She seems to be a big Chris Christie fan. And her argument in the Chris Christie post, it was just this fawning post about how he gave this great interview about public sector unions. And this was right after Mitch Daniels had said we shouldn't take on collective bargaining in Indiana this term. He said we shouldn't take on whether Indiana is a right-to-work state in general, not public sector unions.
Right, because he had already accomplished what Scott Walker was trying to accomplish on his first day in office back in 2005.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like Jennifer Rubin writes this fawning piece about how Chris Christie gave such a tough speech about this thing with unions, and she couldn't even imagine anyone else saying the kind of things that Chris Christie said. And I thought to myself, well, Daniels actually did this. He did this with no fanfare right when he started at the top of Indiana, and I just don't understand it. It seems like Rubin is just looking for someone to have a lot more bluster than Daniels does, and that's kind of the way I feel about a lot of his critics. I've heard, Mark Levin has also been going after Daniels, but I just don't understand how you can go after Daniels and say that he's not presidential, as Levin did, and then turn around and talk about, write a whole Facebook post about how Sarah Palin is being unfairly attacked, and if she runs for president, it'll be all fine and dandy. And I just don't get it. I don't get how a person who, for all my disagreements with him, seems to be intelligent and know a lot about politics, and I don't get saying that Mitch Daniels isn't presidential and then defending Christine O'Donnell and Sarah Palin as good candidates.
Well, I don't listen to Levin as much as you do, and I didn't hear him call Daniels unpresidential, so I can't speak on that. But as far as the truce, You know, I'm definitely sympathetic to what he's trying to say. I just think he's saying it really badly. You know, at a time when, you know, you've got the cultural left constantly trying to push same-sex marriage across the country through the courts. It's just not a good idea to tell conservatives that they need to lay down their arms and call a truce. I mean, first of all, in any type of, you know, GOP primary, words like truce just aren't exactly going to fire up the bases. But, you know, his underlying point that we need to prioritize what the conservative movement stands for and what, you know, we really need to be fighting for, I think that does work. I just think he definitely needs to, you know, recast. Bottom line, I don't think he's thought it through. You know, I was actually, he actually came to the Heritage Foundation for a, you know, kind of on the record, but, you know, invitation only meeting with reporters. And John McCormick for the Weekly Standard was there, as was Jen Rubin. Jen Rubin actually pressed him on foreign policy in that exchange and found his answers wanting. But McCormick asked him about the Mexico City policy. And, you know, he clearly just hadn't thought about it and wasn't ready. And said that, you know, he wouldn't overchange it. And, you know, McCormick reported that. There was a firestorm. And then later in the week, Mitch had to backtrack and say, oh, no, no, you know, that definitely is. We don't want to be spending money on abortion. That's a fiscal issue. So, you know, it appears to me he wants to have this brand out there that, you know, it's all about fiscal sanity. It's all about the entitlements, reining in spending, et cetera. And he wants to be the guy, you know, who's not going to focus on social issues. But he hasn't really figured out how to effectively talk about it yet. And he needs to figure that out pretty quickly. There's two other big obstacles that I see Mitch Daniels having that have gotten some play, but not a lot. But I think they need to be solved if he's going to be before he runs. The first is Dick Lugar, who's up for election in Indiana. And you saw Dick Lugar this week, or actually the week's blend together, maybe it was last week. You saw Dick Lugar last week condemn the House Republican spending bill, the one with $61 billion in cuts. And basically, you know, sounding like Harry Reid, like, oh, no, this, you know, these cuts are mean and unnecessary. And it was like 2 hours later, his office quickly backtracked it, and Lugar was all of a sudden all of a sudden, no, 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 these cuts are great, I'm on board, and he ended up voting the right way. But it just shows that, you know, the political moment has passed him by. Like any normal senator, you know, Claire McCaskill or Ben Nelson wouldn't have, you know, talked about the cuts that way. You know, you have Democrats out there that understand the political environment better than Dick Lugar does. Anyway, he's had a great career, all the rest of it, and of course the larger backstory is that, you know, Daniels, his mentor is Dick Lugar. His first job was in Dick Lugar's office when Dick Lugar was mayor of Indianapolis, moved with him over to the Senate and was worked on his staff there. Daniels got his law degree while working for Lugar. So Lugar's like his political mentor. So it's very hard for Daniels to criticize him, but Daniels simply is not going to be able to get any Tea Party GOP primary votes and support Dick Lugar at the same time. Those two things just can't happen. So he's going to have to figure out a way to, you know, get Lugar out of the race if he's going to have a serious chance. Do you have any comment on that, or I'll go to issue number two?
Not really. I don't know much about the Lugar situation at all, and so I'll leave your commentary alone. One more thing I did want to say about Mitch Daniels.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, but you could understand how, you know, if Obama was not that Lieberman ran in 2008, but if Lieberman had run in 2008, there's no way that Obama could have supported him for Senate.
Yes, I see. I see that. That's true.
That's true. But go ahead.
Yeah. So what I was going to say about Daniels is that I think he's brought up a point about how difficult it will be to reform sort of America's fiscal standing that hasn't really been taken very seriously on the right, and that should be. And what I'm afraid of is that too many grassroots Republicans have the mistaken idea that all it's going to take to sort of get the United States on sound fiscal footing is eliminating foreign aid and eliminating waste in government and, you know, getting rid of earmarks. And that then if we just did those things, we would be okay. This idea that we can sort of leave entitlements alone for the most part, and by that I mean Social Security and Medicare mostly, and that that's going to be somehow a viable thing. And I think that you're seeing some Republicans struggle with this now, where they've sort of pledged that they're not going to touch those things because they're unpopular among their constituents. It's unpopular among their constituents to talk about something like means testing Social Security or raising the retirement age. And so they're forced to really have deep cuts into areas of the budget that not very much money goes to.
Can you give an example of a prominent Tea Party type politician that was elected in 2010 that like you said, is scared to say those things and says that we can only do a cutting discretionary spending?
Well, I think some of the prominent Tea Partiers are actually not afraid. I mean, I've been pleased. The only sort of Tea Party candidate that I was enthusiastic about was Rand Paul, and I've been pleased with his willingness to sort of get into office.
What about Marco Rubio, Senator of Florida, in a debate in the Senate in Florida, which has its share of Social Security recipients, saying that we are going to have to, you know, means test and limit Social Security benefits?
Yeah, I don't disagree that the most popular
that's not bravery and taking the issue head on. I don't know what is.
No, I completely agree, but the Tea Party still isn't enough of the Republican leadership in Washington to actually pass this kind of thing. Do you think that I'm incorrect?
I do think you're incorrect. I mean, look at this last budget fight. You know, Paul Ryan has been trying to get the Republican leadership to take on entitlements in their budget for years. And so in this last go-round, after the president released his budget, Ryan, in his response after the State of the Union, didn't really talk about it. And then you had, after getting the pressure, you had Cantor and Boehner out in front of Ryan saying, yes, of course, entitlements are going to be part of the budget. To which Ryan said, oh, okay, great. Well, we'll definitely do that. I already have a plan out there. So you're seeing, Cantor and Boehner feeling the pressure from their freshmen and getting out ahead of Ryan, who used to be the standard bearer on this. So you definitely have, and it's all coming from the freshmen. They're feeling the heat from the Tea Party blood in there. And you're definitely seeing movement within the Republican leadership to talk about these things head on.
Well, I hope you're right. If so, then my worries then I shouldn't have them, if you're right.
Paul Ryan's going to release his budget in a couple months. We'll find out.
Yeah, and we'll find out not just by what's in the budget, but by how many votes it gets. I'll look forward to it.
Although if it's just in his budget, that's a leadership document. That would be a pretty big step. I mean, it's not like the president had any entitlement stuff in his budget.
Well, sure. That's not a very high bar to do better than. So you would say that when Daniel says, Daniel's sort of core point is it's going to be harder than Republicans are currently acknowledging to actually get these cuts passed, to get them through Congress, to actually reform Social Security, Medicare. These are huge programs that are very popular. Even a lot of Republicans don't want to touch them, and it's going to be very hard to get them through. It's going to be so hard, in fact, that we need to find people who we disagree with strongly on other issues and make a bargain on this. And you disagree with that?
I agree with all of that. I don't see anybody saying it's going to be easy.
Okay. And is it fair to say that you agree with, So you sort of agree with the logic of the truce, but not the way that Daniels is handling it, the rhetoric that
he is. I think it sounded good in his mind, and he wanted to establish that brand, and he said it, but I don't think he thought through the details of, you know, like the Mexico City policy. I don't think he thought through the details of am I going to defend DOMA in court? Do I support the House defending? I don't think he went through every specific policy area where the left and right are always going to be fighting these culture wars, and said, how am I going to come down on this?
My constant worry is that voters on the right are going to allow themselves to be placated by, like, big culture war fights that the Republican leadership picks in place of other things. You know, they'll say, yes, we need to defund NPR, and maybe even they will defund NPR, and then it'll be a big victory. And it's like, that's a kind of victory I fear, because I don't want people to be able to go back to their districts and say, I want NPR, and get a bunch of people, I went on NPR and get a bunch of people cheering and saying, oh, well, you know, you're my conservative hero. It doesn't have anything to do with my opinion about whether NPR should get funding. It's just that I think that sometimes little culture war things substitute for handling big other things that people don't want to touch. So I'm really curious to see how it all plays out between now and 2012.
Well, I'll say one more thing, and then we can transition to NPR. But, you know, just judging from, you know, the my comment section, cutting off funding for NPR would not be nearly enough to satisfy, all the rabid Tea Partiers that are rabid and valued readers of the Foundry that we love. Their sights are on something much, much bigger than NPR.
Right.
But you wanted to talk about NPR.
Yes. So there was this big sting where James O'Keefe, the same guy who did the Acorn undercover videos, he got a meeting set up with a couple of people on the sort of business fundraising side of NPR. And he had a couple of guys pretending that they were involved with some, like, Muslim student group. Or Muslim advocacy organization. So, I mean, it was basically the equivalent of, like, CARE, a smaller, lesser-known CARE. And, in this meeting, the guy Schiller, who was one of the fundraising guys, said some things about Republicans and Tea Partiers that ultimately got him fired. And there were sound bites where he was saying, they're racist, 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 and xenophobic, and I'm forgetting the exact sound bites, but so a really interesting thing happened, which is that some of the other James O'Keefe tapes have been sort of, parts of them have been debunked after the fact, people going in and saying, wow, this is a really misleading edit. In the Acorn story, it was that he didn't actually go into the Acorn offices wearing a pimp outfit. In fact, it was just edited to make it look that way. In fact, he was wearing a suit and tie when he went into the Acorn offices. So in this case, the video analyst who broke this story was working for The Blaze, which is a website owned by Glenn Beck. And the guy, his last name is Baker, I'm forgetting his first name at the moment, but he was a founding editor of Breitbart TV, and he was an editor of Breitbart TV for a period of years. And now he's working for Glenn Beck's website, and it was, for me, the most unexpected place in the world to see a sort of in-depth video analysis debunking a James O'Keefe thing. And they basically pulled out 8 different clips where, for example, there was one supposedly damning quote where Schiller said something bad about Republicans, but if you looked at the full clip, he actually, what you didn't see on tape was that he said, yes, someone that was very high up in the Republican Party and later became dissatisfied with it told me that, and that's when the video picked up. And he said what this other person told him. And there's another part where they made it look like the undercover people basically said, yeah, we call it the National Palestinian Radio. And Schiller seems to be laughing in a kind of a delighted way and say, oh, they told you that. But it turns out they cut it in such a way that when he said, oh, they told you that, it was because the waiters told Schiller oh yeah, you have to go in this other room. This is the people you're meeting, and they send them into the wrong place. And anyway, they're just really sort of egregious editing things. And so to me, this is first a great, fascinating story, a great, fascinating media story. Like Glenn Beck's website is breaking serious stories, and the former editor of Breitbart TV is sort of taking down what some would call a Breitbart protege. And, you know, also interesting is that O'Keefe seemed to partner with the Daily Caller on this story rather than with Breitbart's big government. And it just seems like a great story. And it also seems incumbent on the people who covered the first story that came out to go back and point out to their audience, look, this really quality debunking has been done. And it's not to say that it completely exonerates Shiller of every bad thing that he said. But, you know, it's worth knowing if you bought into the edited version of the story that these outlets posted. And, you know, I know like the National Review and the Weekly Standard both ran with the original story, and Howard Kurtz mentioned this on CNN but hasn't updated his Daily Beast pieces. And so I'm just sort of perplexed that more people aren't running with it. And I guess the last thing I want to say about this before you weigh in with whatever thoughts you have is that, to me, Shiller said some stuff that I think Tea Partiers could be rightly offended by and that I don't think is accurate or true. At the same time, he's on the fundraising side of an organization with a huge wall between the fundraising and the editorial side. And I guess I just can't get that exercised about a sort of ad person saying this kind of thing. I mean, at the newspapers that I've worked at the magazines I've worked at, I don't think it would be accurate or fair to think that what some ad person said in what they thought was a private meeting was somehow reflective of the editorial output that we put out. And Heather McDonald wrote a post about this that I basically agree with, where she said, look, I think it's fine to have various problems with NPR's coverage and to have a problem with it being federally funded, but if you're going to attack the coverage as being biased, attack actual coverage. Don't attack what some guy on the business side said. It's a bad precedent, I think, to just go on witch hunts and try and find someone in an organization to find something offensive so that you can tarnish the organization and get them fired. So that's kind of my whole take on everything NPR-related.
Sure. Well, let's start with this debunking. I thought it was really, really weak tea. You know, I never watched the video, the full one or the shortened one. But, you know, I always remember there was, you know, kind of, you know, three basic, you know, points that everyone was trying to make, which is that, you know, he said a bunch of bad things about conservatives. He said Tea Partiers were seriously racist. And, of course, the other big one was that he admitted that, you know, NPR doesn't need the funding. So, you know, I remember when this debunking came out, and so I looked specifically to those three points. And so this is what the debunking says about those points. Number three, how does Shiller describe Republicans? He clearly says some offensive thing while being very direct that he's giving his own opinion, not that of NPR. Still a wildly stupid move on the Tea Party being seriously racist. As you point out, he says that it is largely recounting the views exposed to him by two top Republicans, one a former ambassador who admitted to him that he voted for Obama. But then this debunking also admits, at the end, he signals his agreement. And then on NPR federal funding, he does admit that NPR does not need the funding and that in the long run it would be better off without it, but that in the short term some local stations are at risk. That's fine with me. Local stations would be at risk, but he still admits, even in the full context, that in the long run, NPR would be better without the funding. So on the three biggest charges that got the most news coverage, this debunking, affirms them all. They're all true. You know, yes, he was recounting what other ambassadors says, but then he agreed with it. Yes, he said some local stations would be in trouble, but he said in the long run, NPR doesn't need the funding. I do think if the whole, you know, back and forth, Daily Caller, Andrew Breitbart, that soap opera by itself is entertaining and, you know, sign me up for some popcorn. But, on the narrow point of this video, and I'm not a James O'Keefe fan, mm-hmm. You know, I think he really nailed the guy.
I would be surprised if you felt that O'Keefe didn't do anything egregious if you watched the edited video and the full video. I think, again, I agree that some of the points that the media plucked out of this stood either way. At the same time, it isn't so clear to me that Schiller is agreeing with everything that the person he was quoting was saying. I don't think that that's clear at all from the video. And the full video and the edited video also allied a lot of parts where, for example, Schiller is saying, you know, I grew up a Republican and I am proud of it. And, you know, lately I've actually voted for more Democrats, but, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with being a Republican. One of the other people, the woman at the table, I don't even know her name, also weighs in and sort of defends the right against the undercover people. And the other interesting thing about watching the full two-hour video is that it becomes pretty clear that what O'Keefe was actually after in this undercover operation, which is that he was basically trying to get NPR to agree on tape to slant coverage because of this $5 million donation. And he kept sort of, the people that he sent, that O'Keefe sent, kept sort of saying, well, you know, what if you did more of this editorial content or more of that editorial content? And repeatedly, both of the business people at the table were like, look, we don't have anything to do with content. We've had other donors say, why don't you cover this a little bit more, or that a little bit more? And they've been, you know, very closely aligned with what people think of as NPR beliefs. And we said, no, we can't. We're not going to take your money. So I think that if you're a conservative who wants to know what people at NPR really think and really say behind closed doors, you're given a very incomplete picture by the edited video, and unfairly so, I think. But again, I encourage, I'm sure they'll put the link up to the daily, or to the Blaze piece on the right side of the screen. And I encourage people to at least scroll through and watch the little video clips that they did, which I think are a much better indication than the descriptions they gave in words.
Yeah, fair enough. So did you want to talk Libya or Manning?
Let's talk Manning first. So Bradley Manning is, of course, accused of leaking a bunch of stuff to WikiLeaks and faces life in prison, possibly death, right? And he's being held in a military prison, not a civilian prison. It's going to be a military trial. There's been a lot of controversy about the conditions that he is being held in. From what I understand, it's basically that he's being forced to sleep naked every night in his cell. He is able to, the only exercise he gets is like walking around a sort of very small room. He's being held in solitary confinement for months on end. And during the night, guards call out to him every 5 minutes and he's forced to answer every 5 minutes, or they come and, you know, wake him up if he's fallen asleep. Basically, he's being held in ways that I would argue are inappropriate. We should treat.
And what are the sources of news we have for this?
We have basically his lawyer is his advocate in the press. There've been a few reports kind of trying to follow up and confirm some of this, and certainly the is it the Pentagon or the Department of Justice? I forget who was on the other side in these stories that I was reading.
It's the DOD that has him.
It's the DOD. So I have not seen the DOD contest any of the basics of his treatment. As far as I know, that part of it isn't contested.
Well, they're not going to rebut everything his lawyer says. You know, his lawyer can say, you know, aliens are invading tomorrow. It's not the DOD's job to rebut everything that comes out of the lawyer's mouth.
Well, sure, but you would think that if the lawyer was making crazy things up that put the DOD in a bad light, they would say, no, that's not how we're holding him at all. They've certainly gone to great length to describe the conditions of prisoners at Guantanamo.
I believe they've issued very perfunctory statements that he's been that he's being held within, you know, DOD, you know, regulation and codes, and that nothing improper is being done.
Right.
Right. So they have issued, you know, perfunctory statements along those lines. It's not like they've said nothing.
Yes. Yes, that's true. So a spokesperson for Hillary Clinton at the State Department, I think his name is Crowley.
P.J. Crowley.
Yeah, was talking to a small seminar at a college. It was like a 12-person class, and said in private that it was counterproductive and
I believe stupid.
Yeah, and this got out in the media, and he was he resigned or was fired or whatever. And the interesting thing about this is it seems like exactly the kind of government whistleblower about inappropriate treatment that President Obama defended during his campaign. I would argue that he also campaigned in a way that suggested he would not be complicit in holding someone in this manner. And whatever you think about the treatment of Manning, and it seems like you and I maybe disagree whether it's appropriate or not, I think we should both be able to agree that it contradicts the standards that Obama set for himself during his campaign.
Well, if they're, you know, depriving him of sleep, I think that's probably outside DOD guidelines. But, you know, I don't take everything that his lawyer says on face value. I went to law school. I know lawyers. I know not to take everything they say as truth. Is this in any way surprising? I mean, you know, Obama's completely failed on Guantanamo and detainee treatment issues since day one. This is really just another, brick in the wall, right? I mean, this isn't the first time you've been disappointed by Obama's leadership on an issue, is it?
No, certainly not. I've been very disappointed in Obama on civil liberty stuff. I know that a few people on the left have too. I think a lot of people on the left have basically given Obama a free pass after writing that various Bush administration policies were
the end of democracy as we know it. Yeah. No, well, right. I think we're in agreement there. There's tons of hypocrisy on the left on this.
And I think for some reason this case, and especially the resignation of Crowley, has gotten has sort of shaken some people up. Glenn Greenwald did a post about this.
Glenn Greenwald's been shaken up for a while.
Yes, he's been hammering on other people on the left for not talking about this stuff. And he did a post after this Crowley thing, saying basically, finally, other liberals are starting to realize what I have been saying about Obama all along. And he points to posts by Iglesias and Ezra Klein. And I don't know if Andrew has mentioned, but Andrew Sullivan wrote a very sort of angry post about the Crowley thing. And of course, he's been an Obama supporter, although he's also been critical of him in the past about civil liberty stuff. So I don't know. I'm hoping that that this is a turning point, that people do try and take this stuff seriously. I know that civil liberties is going to be a big issue for me in 2012. I think it's certainly possible for there to be a Republican that I think is going to be even worse than Obama, even though I think Obama is terrible on this stuff. I also think it's possible that there could be a Republican that ran on a civil libertarian platform attacking Obama.
After looking at Obama's rhetoric and then Obama's actions, what could a Republican possibly say to make you happy? I mean, considering that Obama said all the right things and has now disappointed you.
What could a Republican say to make me happy?
Right.
For example, I would consider a Republican to be worse on civil liberties if they wanted to return to the Bush-era interrogation tactics and start waterboarding people.
Well, even Bush dropped those in 2003, so I don't think anyone wants to go back there.
I don't know if it's accurate to say that no one wants to go back there.
Okay, there probably is a universe of people that do. You're right. Not no one.
there were there are some ridiculous statements during the whole WikiLeaks thing about how we should try Julian Assange for treason, despite the fact that he's not a United States citizen. I think that was Newt Gingrich, if I'm not mistaken.
I think Joe Lieberman said, said the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Lieberman would be a terrible candidate for me.
Okay, well, I think Newt Gingrich has about as much shot as Joe Lieberman does at getting the 2012 Republican nomination.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that any Republican likely to get the nomination has said any of the most egregious things that I've heard. You know, if it were like a Gingrich or a – I mean, the other thing that Gingrich said, he said something during the whole so-called Ground Zero mosque dust-up. Wasn't he the one that said, we'll build a mosque in New York when they build a church in Mecca?
I think it was a synagogue, but you're close.
Yeah. So that's another kind of thing that strikes me as a step farther than even Obama on civil liberties kind of stuff. But I expect that
that
the Republican who gets the nomination is actually going to agree with Obama on most stuff, and it isn't going to be apparent who's better on those issues. I think if the Republican is a little bit better on those issues, it'll probably be tough to convince civil liberties advocates on the left that that's the case. I think that they invest too much meaning in Obama's words and not enough meaning in his action. And, you know, depending on who it is, I may well be making that argument to them and saying, look, if these are the things you care about, you should be supporting this Republican candidate instead of Obama. But I think on that issue, it could go either way, and I'm going to have to wait and see who gets nominated before I know who's going to be better on that stuff.
Well, I don't think any of them have been questioned on this yet, but I'll tell you what I'll be looking for, and that is a candidate who will say, you know, I'm going to take this issue to Congress, we're going to have an honest, open debate about this, and we're going to pass new laws that create a framework for holding non-combatant detainees for the modern world. I think that was a huge failing of the Bush administration, that they failed to go to Congress to get a new legal framework. And Obama has not only continued that failure, but made it worse by punting the issue to the courts. And, I mean, you have judges here in the D.C. federal district that have gone through the very outspoken and odd statement of writing, basically writing op-ed saying to the Obama administration, don't force us, the courts, to make detainee policy. We're federal judges. We do not have the knowledge base and political mandate to, do this issue for you. You need to lead on this. And, of course, Obama has completely failed.
Do you have thoughts on Libya or Libya and Obama foreign policy or whatever?
I think you've seen a pretty, unified Republican message of, no on the no-fly zones. I mean, you still have the Newt Gingriches and the Bill Kristols who are out there in favor of it, and I think probably Lieberman's in that boat too. But here at Heritage, we're so far against the no-fly zone. Same with, I believe, AEI. I think most of the senators that have spoken on it, including actually Dick Lugar's been good on this. He had a statement yesterday. So I think the conservative line right now is we shouldn't get in there until we have a clear policy goal.
Yeah, it's been interesting to see how the right is coming down on this. I know that National Review seems, for the most part, against a no-fly mm-hmm. zone as well, although there are dissenting voices. And at the same time, I see that I think Christopher Hitchens is for doing something, right? It seems like some of the backers, the original backers of the Iraq invasion, sort of feel the same way about Libya. I would like, I don't have any deeply insightful thoughts about this, not knowing all that much about Libya to begin with. I wish there could be some sort of test where anyone who advocates putting military assets in a country, where somehow someone could surprise them and ask them to just name all of the countries on that country's border. And I feel like if they're unable to do so, then that should go a long way to discrediting their assertion that we should put American troops in there. But of course, if this became a standard, then people would be ready for it. But I encourage, if there's some enterprising TV interviewer out there, next time you have someone come on talking about Libya, I encourage you to ask them, can you name all the countries around Libya? If they can't, I would have a hard time taking them seriously.
Fair enough. I think we're at 50 minutes. It's a good place to end.
All right. Sounds good. Well, good luck at the new gig at the Examiner.
And hope you get better and enjoy the warm Southern California sun.
All right. Thanks. Okay, bye-bye. Bye.